Hey, I want to thank you for joining me today. I'm going to do something a little bit different. When I think of the title, Dying to Live, of course, that's also all about as we embrace our death. We truly want to celebrate life and show up big for life. And I was thinking about someone who I had the opportunity to meet back in 2013. I had a conversation, an interview with her also. And she still is making a difference in my life through her books, through her quotes. And I'm speaking about the late, great Dr. Maya Angelou. So in honor of who she was, in honor of the voice that she had that I so wish we still had today, given the trying times our country is going through, I decided that for this week, this podcast would be a replay of that interview I did with Maya Angelou. It was in 2013. She was going to be speaking here in Indianapolis at Butler University. She was kind enough to invite me to meet her backstage. I did meet her. I did have a private conversation with her. And she walked her talk. She was as gracious and sharp as you would hope she would be. And that has always impressed me, and she will always be in my heart. So, if you've heard this before, you're going to get a chance to hear it again. A lot of you are new to this podcast, so you haven't heard this interview. So here is my conversation. First a bio, but the conversation with the great Maya Angelou. Dr. Maya Angelou is one of the most renowned and influential voices of our time. Hailed as a global Renaissance woman, she's a celebrated memoirist, novelist, educator, dramatist, producer, actress, historian, filmmaker, and civil rights activist. Born on April 4, 1928 in St. Louis, Missouri, Angelou was raised in St. Louis in Stamps, Arkansas. Angelou experienced the brutality of racial discrimination while in Stamps, but she also absorbed unshakable faith and values of traditional African-American family, community, and culture. As a teenager, Angelou's love for the arts won her a scholarship to study dance and drama at San Francisco's Labor School. At 14, she dropped out to become San Francisco's first African-American female cable car conductor. She later finished high school, giving birth to her son, Guy, a few weeks after graduation. As a young, single mother, she supported her son by working as a waitress and cook. However, her passion for music, dance, performance, and poetry would soon take center stage. In 1954 and 1955, Angelou toured Europe with a production of the opera Porgy and Bess, studied modern dance with Martha Graham, danced with Alvin Ailey on television variety shows, and in 1957 recorded her first album, Calypso Lady. In 1958, she moved to New York, where she joined the Harlem Writers Guild, acted in the historic off-Broadway production Jean Genet's The Blacks, and wrote and performed Cabaret for Freedom. In 1960, Angelou moved to Cairo, Egypt, where she served as editor of the English-language weekly The Arab Observer. The next year, she moved to Ghana, where she taught at the University of Ghana's School of Music and Drama, worked as feature editor of the African Review, and wrote for the Ghanaian Times. During her years abroad, Angelou read and studied voraciously, mastering French, Spanish, Italian, Arabic, and the West African language Fanti. While in Ghana, she met with Malcolm X, and in 1964 returned to America to help him build his new organization of African American Unity. Shortly after her arrival in the United States, Malcolm X was assassinated and the organization dissolved. And soon after X's assassination, Martin Luther King Jr. asked Angelou to serve as Northern Coordinator for the Southern Christianship Leadership Conference. King's assassination, falling on her birthday in 1968, left her devastated. With the guidance of her friend, the novelist James Baldwin, she began work on the book which would become I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, which was published in 1970 to international acclaim and enormous popular success. The list of her published verse, nonfiction, and fiction now includes more than 30 best-selling titles. A trailblazer in film and television, Angelou wrote the screenplay and composed the score of the 1972 film Georgia, Georgia. Her script, the first by an African-American woman ever filmed, was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. She continues to appear on television and in films, including the landmark television adaptation of Alex Haley's Roots and John Singleton's Poetic Justice, 1997, she directed her first feature film, Down in the Delta. And in 2008, she composed poetry for and narrated the award-winning documentary, The Black Candle, directed by M.K. Asante. Angelou has served on two presidential committees, was awarded the Presidential Medal of Arts in 2000, the Lincoln Medal in 2008, and has received three Grammy Awards. President Clinton requested that she compose a poem to read at his inauguration in 1993, and Angelou's reading of her poem, On the Pulse of the Morning, was broadcast live around the world. Angelou has received more than 30 honorary degrees and is Reynolds Professor of American Studies at Wake Forest University. It's a joy to have her on today's program, and she joins us from her private residence in North Carolina. Dr. Angelou, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be on and with the program. And
first of all, I'd like to congratulate you on receiving the Letarian Award. It's a National Book Award for your famous book, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. What an achievement and long overdue.
Thank you very much. Actually, the award is for lifetime achievement.
Ah,
it's
okay.
All the books, some 31 books.
There you go.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. You know, your writing is so deeply touching to so many, and you've said that when you write poetry, you do it to become closer to all.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, can you share more about this experience for you of being closer to all?
Well, I believe God is all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And each time I do anything, I mean, some things seem to have more immediate impact than others, but each time I cook dinner for someone, I want to do it at the top of my level, the best I can possibly do. I believe that the Creator has put each of us on earth to do the best we can do. Whatever it is, digging ditches or being a lawyer, or having a radio show, and writing books and or speaking. I just think that the better I can do, or the best I can do,
mm-hmm.
will put me closer to what all wants me to do.
Mm. I would love to hear about your discovery of the Unity Church and how that impacted your spirituality. Could you briefly share a little bit about that?
Yes, I had discovered the church through a man who became my mentor,
mm-hmm.
Frederick Wilkerson. He was a voice teacher, a voice clinician, he was called.
Mm-hmm.
He could help people who had trouble with their voices to repair the voice.
Mm-hmm.
And he was wonderful, and he introduced me to Unity, and I enjoyed the church. And then I went away from the States. I went to Europe with Porgy and Bess as their first black, I was really the premier dancers, and I sang the role Ruby, Sporting Life's girlfriend. I left my son for almost a year, and I was so filled with guilt. It was just terrible. When I finally was able to get home, my son hardly spoke to me.
Hmm.
Oh, it was terrible. So I went to a place in San Francisco then called Langley Porter Psychiatric Clinic.
Mm-hmm.
And the receptionist asked if I had an appointment. I said no. She said she couldn't see me. There was no one to see me. So I said, someone must help because I'm about to hurt myself and maybe another person. So she called around and told me to go to a certain office. I went to the office and there was a young white man just looking so spiffy. Button-down shirt and all of this and a good suit. And he said, ask me, what's the matter? And I couldn't tell him. I didn't know how I would say to him what it felt like to be the mother of a black boy,
mm-hmm.
growing up in a racist society,
mm-hmm.
and how guilty I felt leaving him. So he asked me two or three times, and finally I walked out of the office. I thanked him and walked out of the office. And I went to Wilkie, the voice teacher. So I told him, I'm going crazy. He asked me, what's the matter? I said, no, I'm going crazy. He said, no, I mean, what is the real matter? I really became angry. He said, here, sit down, take this yellow pad, and write your blessings. And I thought, I said, that's not what I wanted. He said, just write that you could hear me say, write. And think of all the people in the world who can't hear. Who can't hear their baby's cry. Can't hear the murmur of a lover in their ear. Think of that. And he said, not write that you can hold this pad, the yellow pad, and have this pen. Think of all the people who can't, who are crippled and can't hold even a yellow pad or a book.
Mm-hmm.
Now write down that you can see, and then write down that you can taste. Mr. Brennan, he continues to list for me some of the things that I had taken for granted.
Yes.
And finally, when I came to write down that God loves me,
mm-hmm.
and I said, God loves me. And when I finally let it sink into my psyche,
mm-hmm.
not just into my ears,
mm-hmm.
I thought, God, this element, this creativity, this it who made fleas and flies and mountains and rivers and trees loves me,
mm-hmm.
me, Maya Angelou. Goodness gracious. It still brings me to almost to tears, and maybe two tears,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
without any apology,
mm-hmm.
that I am lovable to the extent that it all loves me. Then there's nothing I can't do, nothing good that I can't attempt to do.
Yes.
And from that day to this, I've never complained about anything. I might report, but I don't complain. This year I'm celebrating my 85th year on the planet.
Oh.
And I like the statement made by Art Linkletter. He said, growing old is not for sissies. So I agree with that. But I don't complain.
Yes. Yes.
If I have a choice, I'd rather grow old than whatever the choice is.
In the 85 years, you have learned a lot. And I loved what you said on Super Soul Sunday about love, what it is, your definition of it, or at least what it empowers. Could you share your thoughts now of what you're learning about this beautiful power of love?
Love is, if you claim it,
mm-hmm.
it's there for all of us. No matter what stroke of bad luck we think seem to be going through,
mm-hmm.
love is there and waiting for us to take it, to admit it, to allow it to be in our lives. And you know, I know that we are told that we should be peacemakers. I agree, and I think we should be peace bringers.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should have peace when we leave our house before even we arrive at a place where it's warlike or bellicose. And so I think that all of that is God.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows me to have the nerve to develop courage and to look at another human being who may have a different complexion than I have.
Mm-hmm.
And her hair may be different, and he may eat different foods prepared in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that I am a human being, and nothing human can be alien to me. When I know that, I know that I have enough courage to treat every human being with respect and appreciation. And kindness and courtesy. Yes.
Mm-hmm. let's talk for a moment about your most recent book, bestseller, Mom and Me and Mom. Released this year, this book talks about your relationship with your mother. You know, from a very early age, you were sent to live with your grandmother. Can you briefly recount the experience, the emotions you felt as you took the ride across the country to live with your grandmother?
I was three and my brother five.
Oh.
And we were, my mother and father agreed to disagree.
Mm-hmm.
And it was probably the best thing that could have happened to my country, that they at least gave us to my father's mother, and didn't continue. They might have imploded on my country, and so it was the best thing that could have happened to me. My grandmother loved me, my father's mother,
mm-hmm.
and she never once kissed me. I stayed with her 10 years. I don't remember her ever once kissing me. But she would call me when she had visitors.
Mm-hmm.
She'd call me out into the room where she was, and she'd say, "Now, sister, pull up your sleeve." And I'd pull up my sleeve, and she'd hold my arm and then ask, "Have you ever seen an arm straighter than this? Look at this arm, straight as a plank. And look at it, smooth and pretty, brown, as smooth and brown as peanut butter." And that was equivalent to being set in her lap and rocked.
Oh.
I mean, you know, she loved me,
mm-hmm.
and had the patience to care for my for some of my ailments.
Mm-hmm.
Because I, at one time, from the time I was 7 until I was 13, I didn't speak to anyone except my brother.
Hmm.
I had been molested when I was 7, and I told the name of the criminal to my brother, who told it to my family,
mm-hmm.
my mother's family.
Mm-hmm.
And the man was put in jail for one day, released, and a few days later he was found dead.
Mm.
And the police came to my mother's mother's house and said the man, it seemed, he had been kicked to death. Mr. Brennan, that was in my hearing. And I thought my voice had killed a man. So it would be better for everybody if I didn't speak. Because I might just kill people. My voice could kill people.
Sure.
That was my 7-year-old logic. It was an amazing punishment I put on myself. And after I'd been with my mother's people about 3 or 4 months, after a while, they wearied it at the presence of this sullen, silent child. So they sent me back to my grandma in Stamps, Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
And this woman who had gone to the third grade in school, who was the daughter of a former slave, owned the only black-owned store in the town of Stamps during the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd braid my hair the way old black ladies still braid girls' hair. I'd sit on the floor on a pillow, and she'd sit down on a chair. And my hair was huge and very curly. And she said, "Sister, Mama don't care. These people call you a moron. You call you an idiot. Mama don't care what they say." And they holler, all these words that you don't.
Sure.
It hurts your feelings. I don't care. Mama don't care.
Mm-hmm.
Mama knows when you and the good Lord get ready, you're going to be a teacher.
Mm.
You're going to teach all over this world. I used to sit there and think, this poor ignorant woman, doesn't she know I would never speak?
My.
I had now, my office sent me over a list of the honorary doctorates I've received.
Uh-huh.
I have 71, and I've taught in Rome at the Rome Opera House, in Tel Aviv at the Habima Theater, and I'm Reynolds Professor at Wake Forest University,
mm-hmm.
and it's a lifetime appointment.
Mm-hmm.
just amazing.
You've come a long way from a
little
girl.
A long way from this sullen, silent child.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, sir. In Stamps, Arkansas.
Yeah.
A town about as big as your studio.
You know, you also say that your mother was a terrible parent of young children, but
yes,
a great parent of young adults.
That's true. You know, I think people blame themselves when they are bad parents, that is, careless parents,
mm-hmm,
with children.
Mm-hmm.
But my mother said, and I had to ask her not to say that, because it still hurt just to hear her.
Sure.
She said I was about 2 or 3 years old, and I had asked for something, and she didn't give it to me. And I hit her on the leg. She said without thinking, she backhanded me right off the porch into the dirt. And she said when she looked at me in the dirt and realized what she had done, she said, I don't have it. I don't have it to be a mother.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't have that. And that's for that, I'm sure, helped in their, my mother and father breaking up,
mm-hmm,
and them sending me to my grandma.
Yes.
So,
yes.
But as a parent of a young adult from the time I was 14,
mm-hmm,
she was incredible. She understood me. She had patience, and I could recite things to her because I was starting to talk. And she'd ask me to recite statements like Rudyard Kipling's If,
mm-hmm,
and some of the poetry of Paul Laurence Dunbar.
Mm-hmm.
And she was so proud. And she made me smile. She'd say, oh, come and let the mother see you smile. Come on, come on. And she would, and I was proud. She said, look at my baby. Her mother's baby has a beautiful smile. It was so, she won me.
Yeah.
She won my heart.
Yes. In the book, you recount the experience of reconciling with your mother after having lived with your grandmother. Can you tell us how you felt when you and your mother finally reconciled?
Oh, I was so relieved.
Mm-hmm.
I was relieved because she called me darling,
oh,
and she called me baby, and I was just sweet. And I hadn't been called any of those things. And I resisted it because it was so new to me. You like tasting something that looked strange,
mm-hmm,
and was never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
But finally, I had to agree that she loved me, and that she was a good woman, because she was very pretty,
mm-hmm,
and she had money. She owned a hotel, and pool halls,
mm-hmm,
and she had so. She was young, she was had health, and yet she never laughed at anybody. I mean, you know how some people, as soon as a person, a crippled person or a person who's hungry or poor, walks out of the room, people, if they don't say something rude, they make a face and shake their hands and, you know, like, what a shame.
Yes.
My mother never did that.
Oh.
And I admired that in her. When I was pregnant at 16, just graduating from high school,
mm-hmm,
and unmarried,
mm-hmm,
I told her, told to her, and she asked me, do you know who the father is? I said, of course. I only had sex once. And she asked me, do you love him? I said, no. She asked, does he love you? I said, no. She said, very good. Then we're going to have no point in ruining 3 lives. We're going to have a beautiful baby. She's all of that.
That's beautiful.
Really?
Yeah.
And she loved him.
Yes.
And loved me. And she told me once, you can take your baby. I said I was leaving her house.
Mm-hmm.
But when you cross my door, Steph, remember you've already been raised. You know the difference between right and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Do right.
Mm-hmm.
And know this, you can always come home.
Mm.
And many times I did go home, mm, bringing my baby and trailing whatever few pieces of furniture we had. And my mother was, you'd think that it was Christmas or something. Mm-hmm. She'd call her friends and say, hey, you can't guess what? The baby's at home. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, don't come right now. I'm going to be with her for a few hours. Let me have her to myself. But then you can come tonight and have dinner. Yes.
Oh,
she was excellent.
Oh. We've talked about your experience as a child. How about your experience as a mother? Do you have any memories that stand out?
Oh, yes. My son, the best thing that ever happened to me in my life was the birth of my son and having the responsibility to raise him.
Mm-hmm.
I told him when he was about 7 or 8 or 9, all through those years, that he had a place inside him that must be kept clean, mm-hmm. pristine. Nobody, no wife or husband, no child, no priest or rabbi or pastor, mm-hmm. nobody had the right to enter that place because it may be the place you go to meet God when you die.
Mm-hmm.
Don't let anybody misuse that.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him also that I would tell him what to do, and if he didn't agree, he could talk to me and try to talk me out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But if he didn't convince me, I had the last word. And so I married it a few times, and my then husbands would say to my son, I want you in by 10. And my son would ask, why? And the men would say, because I said so, uh-oh. And so they couldn't understand how trying to raise this black boy, I had to give him some rights.
Sure.
But in the end, I did spank him when he was about 7.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd gone into my purse and taken some chewing gum. I asked, where did you get that? He said, in your purse. So I told him, you know you're not supposed to go into my purse. You know that. Why did you do it? He said, I wanted it. So I gave him a spanking. And when I finished, he said, I said, I hope you never do that again. He said, so do I. So I said, after I've given you a seeing to, you still have lip? He said, I hope you never hit me again. Do you realize how big you are? I'm only 7 years old. So I told him, all right, I promise you I'll never hit you again.
Yeah.
And I never did. I said, but on the other hand, you will have to convince me and explain to me why you're going against something I've asked you not to do.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time he was 10, because every time he'd do something, I'd save up until he wanted to go someplace.
Mm.
And I'd just sit down, please, and explain to me why you did what you did last month. Last week,
mm-hmm.
his mom. They're waiting for me. Our team is going to play. No, I'm sorry. Please explain to me. And so finally, by the time he was 10, he asked me, "Why don't you give me a spanking like other kids? And let me go to no." So of course I had to raise him, and that was the only way I had. And he said, he's told this many times. People ask him, how did it feel growing up in Maya Angelou's shadow? He said, in her shadow. I was raised in her light.
Oh.
She seemed to see me all the time. I got very uncomfortable.
You have so many quotes I love, but one of my favorites is, a bird doesn't sing because it has an answer. It sings because it has a song.
That's right.
Can you talk about the importance of singing your song, of expressing your soul, your voice to the world?
Well, the truth is, nobody can beat being you but you.
Yeah.
And it's pitiful when you see people trying to imitate other people.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is, they have their own way of being in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And if it is said that no snowflake is alike, I don't know who has managed and measured all the snowflakes, but I know that no human being is exactly alike. We come here alone. And we may have the blessing to fall in love with someone
mm-hmm.
or have some family member with whom one feels so close. But the truth is, you can't be as close as a person is to herself, mm-hmm. to himself. Mm-hmm. So you have something to say, some gift to give the world. You're here for some reason. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that the Creator ever lost any of its creativity. So I have a role to play. I have something I'm supposed to do. I believe that.
You speak all over the country at so many different universities, inspiring graduating classes as they prepare to go out into the world. And I think this is such a pivotal time for young adults, and you give so many inspiring words of advice for their journey. Can you tell us one of your favorite pieces of advice about life?
Yes, I really got this from James Baldwin.
Uh-huh.
And the statement is, you've already been paid for.
Oh, I love that.
And I love it. And I say whether your ancestors came from Eastern Europe, mm-hmm. trying to escape the pogroms, the little and large murders, mm-hmm. if they came from Ireland trying to escape the potato blight, which is here not only Ireland, but the area which was to become Germany, and it was also assailed by the potato blight. Mm-hmm. If the ancestors came from Asia in the 1850s to build this country, to build the railroads, unable legally to bring their mates or spouses, mm-hmm. or to even own property in the land they were helping to develop, building the roads and the railroads. And if the ancestors came from South America, from the islands, and if indeed the ancestors came from Africa unwillingly, lying spoon fashion in the filthy hatches of slave ships, and in each other's excrement and urine and menstrual flow, they have paid for each of us already. Mm. And Jimmy Baldwin said that. Then I took it as far as I could take it, mm-hmm. with that idea, mm-hmm. realizing that all I really had to do was prepare myself so I could pay for someone else who was yet to come.
Oh, beautiful. Your presence and your words have inspired millions all around the world. I'm curious, who or what inspires you these days?
Oh, love it inspires me. Love between a man and a woman, a man and a man, a woman and a woman, an adult and a child. Mm-hmm. A child, yes, love inspires me. Mm-hmm. And so I can be inspired by a country song, or a song of Ray Charles. Mm-hmm. I can be inspired by the poetry of Eugene Redmond and Amiri Baraka and Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Nikki Giovanni. Yes.
Yes.
I can be inspired.
Beautiful.
By Sylvia Plath.
And speaking of university appearances, I know you'll be here in Indianapolis at Butler University next week on September 25th. We're really looking forward to having you here.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm looking forward to being there. You have a great poet living in Indianapolis, Marie Evans.
Yes.
One of the great poets in English.
Oh.
I love her work.
Well, you've honored us for being on today's program. Thank you so much, Dr. Angelou, for the work that you're doing in the world and the light that you're shining.
Thank you. Will you please come backstage and say hello to me?
I will do that, ma'am.
I would love that.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
In closing, I'd like to share with you one of my favorite Maya Angelou quotes, and then one of my favorite Maya Angelou prose poems. Here's the quote. I've learned that no matter what happens or how bad it seems today, life goes on, and it will be better tomorrow. I've learned that you can tell a lot about a person by the way he or she handles these three things: a rainy day, lost luggage, and tangled Christmas lights. I've learned that regardless of your relationship with your parents, you'll miss them when they're gone from your life. I've learned that making a living is not the same as making a life. I've learned that life sometimes gives you a second chance. I've learned that you shouldn't go through life with a catcher's mitt on both hands. You need to be able to throw something back. I've learned that whenever I decide something with an open heart, I usually make the right decision. I've learned that when I have pains, I don't have to be one. I've learned that every day you should reach out
and touch someone. People love a warm hug or just a friendly pat on the back. I've learned that I still have a lot to learn. And I've learned that people will forget what you said. People will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. And finally, this prose poem, she wrote so many. This is called Still I Rise. You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still, like dust, I'll rise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? 'Cause I walk like I've got oil wells pumping in my living room. Just like moons and like suns, with the certainty of tides, just like hope springing high, still I'll rise. Did you want to see me broken? Bowed head and lowered eyes? Shoulders falling down like teardrops weakened by my soulful cries? Does my haughtiness offend you? Don't you take it awful hard, 'cause I laugh like I got gold mines digging in my own backyard. You may shoot me with your words. You may cut me with your eyes. You may kill me with your hatefulness, but still, like air, I'll rise. Does my sexiness upset you? Does it come as a surprise that I dance like I've got diamonds at the meeting of my thighs? Out of the huts of history's shame, I rise. Up from a past that's rooted in pain, I rise. I'm a black ocean, leaping and wide, welling and swelling, I bear in the tide. Leaving behind nights of terror and fear, I rise. Into a daybreak that's wondrously clear, I rise. Bringing the gifts my ancestors gave, I am the dream and the hope of the slave. I rise. I rise. I rise. Maya Angelou, she touched all of our hearts in a very, very profound way. And yes, she is still missed. Hey, I want to thank you for hanging out with me today. You can tune into all the podcasts. I want to remind you to go to the archives. There's a lot of past shows back there as well. And I hope you join me next week for a new interview. That is today's program. I want to thank my engineer, Thomas Gismondi, and production coordinator, Angel Richardson, for helping to make this possible. I'm Richard Brendan. You've been listening to Dying to Live.